Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with a way to address the main concern many Americans have over Donald Trump's fitness to be commander-in-chief, which has to do with his temperament, as Hillary Clinton noted often and turned into a campaign theme that we don't want someone with such a thin skin close to the nuclear button. Joseph Cerincione, the president of the Plowshares Fund and author of Bomb Scare, The History and Future of Nuclear Weapons, joins us to discuss his article at the Huffington Post, Keep Donald Trump's Finger Off the Nuclear Button, and steps that President Obama can take, such as, with the stroke of a pen, taking America's nuclear missiles off high alert so that Donald Trump could not launch them rashly. Then we will speak with James Henry, one of the world's leading investigative economists, who has written widely about offshore and onshore tax havens, kleptocracy, and private banking. He is a senior fellow at Columbia University's Center for Sustainable Investment, a global justice fellow at Yale University, a senior advisor to the Tax Justice Network, and the author of The Blood Bankers. He joins us to discuss his latest report at The American Interest, The Curious World of Donald Trump's Private Russian Connections, and how, after Trump was blackballed by American banks following his many bankruptcies, he turned to financing from Russian oligarchs and gangsters, many of whom ended up residing in Trump Tower. Then finally, we will examine how much Donald Trump and his children are pushing the ethical envelope in terms of trading access for money, and whether we are heading into a pay-to-play presidency with Trump's children, who will be running Trump's business enterprises, trading access for donations to their favorite charities or other entities, as they have already tried to do. Sheila Krumholz, the executive director of the Center for Responsive Politics, who tracks money, politics, and influence in Washington, joins us to discuss how much this new president, who plays by his own rules, will follow the existing rules that govern money influencing politics. And joining us now is Joseph Cerincione, the president of the Plowshares Fund and author of Bomb Scare, The History and Future of Nuclear Weapons. He previously directed nonproliferation international policy programs at the Center for American Progress and the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, has also worked on the professional staffs of the House Committee on Armed Services and the Committee on Government Operations, and served as the staff director of the Bipartisan Military Reform Caucus. He has an article at the Huffington Post, Keep Donald Trump's Finger Off the Nuclear Button. Welcome to Background Briefing, Joseph Cerincione.
Thank you, Ian. It's always a pleasure to join you.
Well, thank you, Joe. And I think you've come up with a novel answer, given how much Hillary Clinton made an issue out of Donald Trump's thin skin and having access to the nuclear button. It almost became a centerpiece of her campaign. What you're telling us in this article, Huffington Post, is that by a simple stroke of the pen, President Obama can take American nuclear missiles off high alert so that Donald Trump could not launch them rashly. So explain further, if you will.
Sure. This was the most quoted line from Hillary Clinton's acceptance speech at the Democratic National Convention. A man that can be baited with a tweet cannot be trusted with the command of our nuclear arsenal. And it's true. This is the issue of all the issues that scare us about Donald Trump, that worry us about Donald Trump. This is perhaps the most significant, that he is so impetuous, so temperamental, so unpredictable, that once he actually has control of the massive U.S. nuclear arsenal, he might actually use it. And it is ridiculously easy for him to do it. This is a problem in our system that is now exacerbated by the questions about the judgment of the man who's about to be our commander-in-chief. Starting at noon on January 20th, Donald Trump will be followed by a military officer with the commands and controls for our nuclear arsenal. He carries it around in a briefcase. He follows the president everywhere he goes. He sleeps outside his room at the White House or wherever he's sleeping. If the president were to decide to launch a nuclear attack, it is his decision and his decision alone. There's no requirement for consultation. There's no vote with the Congress. There's no appeal to the Supreme Court. He doesn't even have to call a cabinet meeting. He turns to that officer. He could say he wants to do it. The officer opens up a command and control book, and he has options from 1 to 1,000 warheads would be at his disposal. And from the time he gives the order, it takes approximately 4 minutes before those missiles fly. And once they fly, no matter what you've seen in the movies, there's no calling them back. There's no self-destruct mechanism. There's no recall. President Obama can prevent that scenario before he leaves office. It's up to the president what the alert rate of these missiles should be. And the president could say, I no longer require that these missiles be ready to launch in 4 minutes. Stand down. He doesn't eliminate the weapons. He doesn't take the warheads off the missiles. He just says, I don't need them to be ready to launch in 4 minutes. And you could extend the time that it would take to launch these missiles from minutes to hours or even days. That would allow for consultations, for some deliberation, perhaps for some interventions. It doesn't affect our national security. It doesn't make us weaker. In this case, more time makes us stronger.
But what happens if we've known in the past there have been computer glitches that have shown incoming missiles, and even on the Russian side, it's happened a couple of times. Mercifully, a launch officer didn't follow protocol. This was in September of 1983. He actually got fired, and then when Yeltsin was in office. They took the Russian equivalent of the footballers called the Cheget to him and said, there's a nuclear attack, and it turned out to be a Norwegian research rocket. And fortunately, it curved away, and thus we didn't have a Russian response. So how do you get rid of that? Because it's one thing to decide not to be on high alert, but what do you deal with incoming, whether it's real or not?
Right. So this is the whole point of taking these weapons off what we call hair trigger alert, or some people call launch on warning, or some just high alert. This is an artifact of the Cold War. We came up with this method and this requirement when commanders feared that there would be a bolt out of the blue for a strike from the adversary, and that they would be targeting our missiles. So we had to be able to launch those missiles before the other guy's missiles could hit us. Well, it takes about 30 minutes for an ICBM to fly from Russia to the United States or vice versa. So you had to launch these things quickly. But now we have nearly invulnerable submarines. We have bombers that can take off. And the prospect of there being a bolt out of the blue attack is remote. It's highly unlikely that Russia would do this to us or us to them. So we no longer need this rapid launch. And if you just eliminate that, it doesn't mean you can't use a nuclear weapon, one or, God forbid, hundreds. But you don't have to use it right away. You don't have that pressure. You don't have that rush. We estimate that a president, if told we were under attack, would have somewhere between 5 and 10 minutes to be briefed on the situation and decide. That is an insanely short amount of time under these circumstances. We could ride it out. You could wait to see, as Yeltsin did in 1995, wait to see if this missile actually is hitting. And if it is, you still have responses. And if it isn't, well, you prevented this mistake. You prevented a computer glitch or a faulty tape or a misunderstanding from launching a nuclear war that could be the end of the world. It's a simple thing to do. In fact, President Obama promised he would do it 8 years ago when he was running. He specifically pointed out that this was a relic of the Cold War. It was a dangerous tactic, and he would eliminate it. But he got a lot of pushback once he got in office. He had other things to do. He didn't do it. He's got 30 days to see if he can correct that mistake, to see if he can at least keep Trump's finger a few hours or days from the nuclear button and not a matter of minutes.
So, in effect, you're standing down the land-based leg of the triad. Is that what it is?
Exactly. That's exactly right. Most of the weapons we're worried about, all those 420 land-based ICBMs, each of which has a warhead approximately 10 times the size of the bomb that destroyed Hiroshima.
So, one of the things that I find ironic is that you know, you have Trump being very friendly to Putin and Tillerson being, I think, the most highly awarded American from Putin in terms of being given mm-hmm. this extraordinary medal by Putin.
Yeah, the Order of Friendship. He is a medal-carrying friend of Putin.
Right. So you got these two guys about to, presumably, if he gets confirmed, be the president and the foreign policy chief. It's not inconceivable that in terms of gestures, because, you know, they're talking about we're going to do better with Russia, and there is real angst. Now, a lot of the angst about Russia's nuclear weapons and returning to the Cold War and going back to launch on warning, that was actually fed by Russian disinformation in this last election. They were feeding that to make American liberals insecure about Hillary Clinton, who was being portrayed as a hawk. So it's not inconceivable to me that the very deal that you're talking about could be one of the first things that Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin agree to.
Well, that is actually my plan B, or plan T in this case. There are so many unknowns with Donald Trump. I mean, seriously, no one knows what he is going to do. It's an almost unprecedented situation. He hasn't had a long article in Foreign Affairs laying out his strategy. He hasn't given a long, thoughtful interview on what exactly he wants to do. There's no real program that says what he's going to do on national security. It's all tweets and comments and excerpts of speeches. So we don't know what he's going to do. So that's why, while we have a known quantity, while we have Barack Obama in office, let's press him to do this one last thing. He's been issuing environmental orders left and right, preventing drilling in the Arctic, preserving wild wetlands, etc. If he can do that on that part of the environment, just do this and protect the whole planet. But if he doesn't, well, you're absolutely right, Ian. Republican presidents can make sweeping arms control agreements with the Russians or Soviets that Democrats find impossible to make for domestic political reasons. It is quite possible that one of the upsides of having a president who wants to have friendly relations with Russia and a Secretary of State who has made billion-dollar contracts with the president of Russia is that they might be able to come to an agreement that, one, takes these weapons off alert, says we're not going to attack each other, we don't need this anymore, and two, might actually cut the nuclear arsenals of both countries and in the process be able to cut some of these unnecessary, extremely expensive nuclear weapons programs that both sides are now rushing to build. So it's possible. And if Obama doesn't do this in the next 30 days, well, people like me, and we immediately shift to that. What can we do to convince Trump to make this deal?
Well, what concerns a lot of people is that whereas Trump is certainly inexperienced and perhaps rash, the people under him that would provide the necessary adult supervision are at that critical nexus, and that is the National Security Advisor and the National Security Council itself. And there's as many misgivings about Michael Flynn as there are about Donald Trump, if not more. And you've got and the rest of the National Security Council, the deputies, Katie McFarland is a lightweight and a propagandist for Fox News, as is Monica Crowley. So you don't have any adult supervision on the National Security Council. You've got conspiracy theorists and ideologues.
Yes, yes. You know, so you're absolutely right. So while I have deep concerns about the massive conflict of interests that Rex Tillerson would bring into the Secretary of State position, you know, what does he care more about, the contracts that he's negotiated with various dictators, including Putin around the world, or the human rights and labor rights that he's going to be in charge of safeguarding? And General Mattis, as Secretary of Defense, quite frankly, everybody breathed a sigh of relief on the Democratic side and the Republican side when he was named. He's considered a fairly steady hand. But the National Security Council, the people who talk to the president the most, those are three wild cards that you just mentioned. And not even wild like Reagan years or George W. Bush years. I mean, Flynn is just outside the pale of normal national security considerations. This is a genuine conspiracy theorist. 2 weeks ago, he met with the far-right head of the Austrian Freedom Party, a neo-Nazi party in Austria, a party that had just negotiated a cooperation agreement with Putin. And he's meeting with this guy in Trump Tower. It's an extremely odd and dangerous situation. And Flynn might be the guy who's making a recommendation to President Trump that we should use a nuclear weapon, so not a whole-scale launch, but a nuclear weapon against ISIS, for example, to go after them, to demonstrate our resolve. He might have a wild theory that this is what you need to show that we're serious, and this will scatter the ISIS forces. You want to defeat ISIS? Here's my quick atomic plan. That's what you worry about as well. So even while you're trying to fix this overall problem with Russia, and you might be able to get an agreement, you really would like to be able to take Trump's finger further away from that button and take him off alert is one way. There are people in Congress who are talking about introducing bills next year to require congressional approval before we were to use a nuclear weapon first, for exactly this reason. All these concerns are things that were there with other presidents, but they're there in spades with this president.
And, of course, if you did use a nuclear weapon against the Islamic State, it wouldn't work. And that would be one of the many reasons why it's an insane idea.
It is. But you know, in the history of the nuclear age, there have been many times where some commanders have recommended
using Vietnam and Korea. Yeah, I know.
Yes. The French wanted us to use a nuclear weapon to break the siege of Dien Bien Phu in 1954. MacArthur wanted to use nuclear weapons against the Chinese in Korea. And presidents have never said yes.
Right.
This president might.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Joseph Cirincione.
Thank you very much, Ian. Anytime.
Definitely. And again, I've been speaking with Joseph Cirincione, who's the president of the Plowshares Fund and the author of Bomb Scare, The History and Future of Nuclear Weapons. He previously directed nonproliferation and international policy programs at the Center for American Progress and the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. And he also worked on the professional staffs of the House Committee on Armed Services and the Committee on Government Operations and served as a staff director of the Bipartisan Military Reform Caucus. And he has an article at the Huffington Post, Keep Donald Trump's Finger Off the Nuclear Button. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about Trump's financial ties to Russian oligarchs and gangsters.
But the Adams here, in spite of hysteria, it flourishes in Utah as well as Siberia. And whether you're a black, white, red, or brown, the question is this when you boil it down. To be or not to be, that's the question. The answer to it all ain't military Adam, like who gets there firstest with the mostest Adams. No, the people of the world must decide their fate. They got to get together or disintegrate. I hold this truth to be self-evident that all men may be cremated equal.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is James Henry, an investigative economist and lawyer who has written widely about offshore and onshore tax havens, kleptocracy, and pirate banking. He is a senior fellow at the Columbia University Center for Sustainable Investment, a global justice fellow at Yale, a senior advisor at the Tax Justice Network, and a member of the New York Bar, and the author of The Blood Bankers. And he has an article at The American Interest, The Curious World of Donald Trump's Private Russian Connections. Welcome to Background Briefing, James Henry.
Good to be here.
And so far, Donald Trump has written new rules for campaigner and for a president. He's never released his tax returns. He doesn't have press conferences. Nobody in the press ever asked him about his service in Vietnam or lack of service in Vietnam, as they did with Clinton and George W. Bush. And he's been very reluctant to divest himself of his business holdings, as other presidents have done according to tradition, in terms of releasing your taxes also according to tradition. But Trump says the normal rules don't apply to me, so too bad. Now, apparently the public's not sufficiently upset by this. The president weren't able to get him to release his tax return. They're even talking about suing the New York Times for what they were able to reveal. So let's begin with that premise. Do you think the American people care? Because I would think if you're going to elect a president, you should know who he owes money to, who has leverage over him, who has influence over him.
Well, we open our article with a quote from Cervantes, which says, tell me who you walk with and I'll tell you who you are. I think what I focused on in this piece was not the Putin relationship, which has received a lot of attention, but Trump's extensive connections with former and current Russia slash former Soviet Union oligarchs, mobsters, and fraudsters of all kinds. And there's a bunch of different cases that we really pulled together. I think part of the answer to your question is that the American media this year had a very hard time keeping up with Trump's ability to kind of change the topic on a day-to-day basis. And so, you know, there wasn't a sustained examination like we should have had of a lot of these connections that I've identified that are just sitting there kind of crying out for investigation. I mean, I'm with the two or three assistants, I've been doing this kind of investigation for the last 3 months. But I'm amazed that, you know, the Washington Post, New York Times didn't get into some of the stuff that we've been finding. And so, you know, I think it it kind of exposes one of the vulnerabilities of the mass media, which is they are subject to this kind of myth of the daily news where, you know, there's just Trump was able to play them like a violin.
Well, of course, the big revelations that have come out had nothing to do with the mainstream press. The International Investigative Journalism Consortium came up with the Panama Papers. So is that a part of the problem, that the newspapers and TV networks no longer have the investments in investigative journalism, that it takes people like you to do this?
I've been doing this for, you know, I've been doing this for 40 years. I mean, I was chief economist at McKinsey, I was economics and law, and I've been writing about havens forever. So, yes, I think it is a subject that we, you know, requires a lot of basic training, and it also requires sustained effort. So, you know, we without the Panama Papers, for example, which we've mined for this piece, you know, we wouldn't have discovered all of the interconnections. The main story that we're telling here is one about a network of people and not just any individual case. So, you know, what the media usually focuses on, or even law enforcement for that matter, is not the network of relationships over time, but, you know, particular individual scandals and cases. So we had, for example, the example of Trump's former campaign manager, Manafort, who, you know, turned out had been very close to a Ukrainian billionaire, Firtash, who, you know, in turn has admitted that he's close to a guy named Mogilevich, who's widely reputed to have been the boss of bosses in Moscow. You know, this got a kind of vertical coverage, but no one really said, well, you know, who else is Firtash related to? Who else has Manafort been serving, and who else has Mogilevich been in touch with? And when you do that, you find out that some of his people had, you know, up to five apartments in the Trump Towers, that another close relationship was involved with a bunch of deals that took place, you know, through a company called Bayrock, you know, which up and down the East Coast of the United States. A third one was involved with the Toronto Trump Tower. All of these, by the way, kind of big project failures. Ultimately, the Trump Soho, for example, failed. The Trump Tower in Toronto failed. And so the basic question I asked in this piece is sort of, how do we account for Putin and for Trump to begin with? because if we really have to go back to the 1990s and dig into, you know, what made Putin and what really made Putin possible, as well as Trump here, was the fact that Russia collapsed. There was enormous depression in the Soviet economy. After the fall of the wall, the Russian economy collapsed into a 1930s depression. At the same time, with the aid of the West, really, we reconcentrated wealth in Russia. So there was an enormous amount of transfer of wealth with the help of financing from, you know, institutions like the IMF and the World Bank. By the Yeltsin government, they ended up essentially handing much of the natural resources in Russia to a tiny oligarchy of 25 or 30 people, you know, with a lot of help from mobsters. So the place became really not a symbol of democratic capitalism, but just the opposite. And then naturally, I think that produced not only the reaction that led to Putin concentrating power in a kind of nationalist coup, but also a tremendous outpouring of funny money, of capital flight from Russia, to the point where there's now more than $1.3 trillion offshore of Russian capital wealth, capital flight wealth, most of it owned by a tiny group of people, you know, just not being reinvested in the economy. And Trump helped himself to that. You know, he was at a stage in the early 2000s when he just had six bankruptcies in a row. The only way he could possibly finance the new deals he wanted to do in that period in real estate and casinos and towers was to turn to sort of funny money from abroad. And as Donald Trump Jr. said in 2008, after having visited Russia, you know, six times in the last 18 months, you know, more than most of our money is coming from Russia. So it was this period of enormous capital flight as well as the rise of Putin, that I think really explains a lot of the subsequent history.
So, Jim Henry, then, what is the walk us through some of what you've been able to find out in your investigative journalism about Trump's relationship to these oligarchs and Russian gangsters, you know, in terms of we know that he was blackballed by Wall Street because he took so many banks down. He had to look for capital. He found it in Russia. But was it Putin's guys, the Siloviki, the ones around him, or is it all these the oligarchs who parked their money offshore? What exactly is the relationship here that leads many people to wonder, because quite simply, Donald Trump has gone out of his way to say nice things about Putin. And even now, as the intelligence community keeps insisting that more and more likely that Putin tipped the scales in Trump's favor, Trump's doubling down. But it just makes you wonder more and more, what is this relationship about? And
we go into five different cases here and look at the networks across the different cases. But I'll just give you one example. There was this company in New York, which was called Bayrock LLC. They undertook the Trump Soho on Spring Street, a 32-story building. Trump was an 18% equity partner in that. It wasn't just a licensing deal. But the two other partners that involved there were this Bayrock company, which is basically run by a couple of criminals. And, you know, people who have been convicted of felonies and fraud all over the planet, one with great contacts in Kazakhstan and Turkey, and the other, you know, a Russian-American who basically had been convicted of, you know, stabbing someone in a bar fight with margarita glass and, you know, involved in stock fraud back in the late 1990s. This is a fellow that ended up running Bayrock as the COO and was carrying a Trump a card that said he was a senior advisor to Donald Trump as of 2008. So, you know, with Bayrock went out and they raised $50 million from Iceland, among other places, to build this Trump Tower. And when they went to Iceland, I mean, the group that they contacted, you know, how many people are going to Iceland for money? Iceland has another whole story that we tell about, you know, a lot of connections between Russian money and Icelandic banks. And, you know, so in that case, this was Exhibit A of the kind of the careless investments that were being made and that Trump was able to profit from with the help of basically people who were Russian mobsters. So whether he knew about the nature of the mobsters or how much he knew is really beside the point. There's a serial pattern here, which is that there's no question that he is not scrupulous about choosing his partners and associates. He basically doesn't do much due diligence with respect to them. That's at a minimum. We can say that. And beyond that, I think the American people ought to look into these connections. So we are really doing unfortunately, we couldn't get this done in time for the election. But I think if ordinary Americans read the piece and just looked at the wide range of dubious connections here. Another case involving the Toronto tower was ultimately a kind of the godfather in that situation was a fellow who had worked closely with Mogilevich and was identified in the FBI reports as being one of his key people. And he ends up, being very helpful to the folks who were ultimately financing that that tower, which has just gone belly up as of November. So the pattern here is, a string of failures. Trump is being able to turn to, all this dubious money just to bail himself out. And the only way he's at the end of the day, it's kind of he's left standing, but all of his investors and partners and customers and, sort of the stockholders are, surrounded and angry and wondering what happened. And somehow, at the end of all this, he begins to, become a politician, and people are persuaded that he's some kind of success.
You're telling us something about the work that you've just done, and you said, Jim Henry, that you would have liked to have gotten it out before the election. But it is out now in an extensive article at The American Interest, and it's called The Curious World of Donald Trump's Private Russian Connections. And again, James Henry's investigative economist and lawyer. He's written widely about offshore and onshore tax havens, kleptocracy, and pirate banking. He's a senior fellow at Columbia University Center for Sustainable Investment, a global justice fellow at Yale, a senior advisor to the Tax Justice Network, and a member of the New York Bar, and the author of The Blood Bankers. So let's now talk about, it seems to me that given that these Russian gangsters and oligarchs essentially bailed Donald Trump out after he got blackballed by Wall Street because of all of his bankruptcies, he couldn't borrow money here, so he turned to this offshore dirty money. How come all these guys ended up living in Trump Tower? Is that a part of the deal? You give me money and I'll give you a free pad?
We don't know enough about this. In fact, one thing I want to make clear is that we're not alleging, any of this is necessarily illegal. There is, that's kind of a law enforcement question. I mean, I would love to see, a Senate investigation or an independent commission formed. It's not going to happen, obviously. But, we're as journalists. We're basically working to identify credible allegations that have been made in published sources, put them together in a place that lets us see across the whole panoply of these relationships. We've just limited so far to Donald Trump himself. When you begin to open the door and look at open the commoda and look at, let's say, the current head of ExxonMobil, Rex Tillerson, who has just been appointed Secretary of State. He's about to have to go before the Senate in January. ExxonMobil has 142 has subsidiaries, 20 in the Bahamas. One of them was disclosed in The Guardian this week. It's a joint venture with a Russian company. They also have joint ventures with Angola and Chad, places that are routinely reported to be subject to the payment of commissions and bribes in terms of their oil deals. So, I mean, there's another whole set of relationships that we really, the American people ought to be insisting that their public officials are able to withstand scrutiny for the kind of business deals that they've been involved with. And I think the Trump administration, because it is, going to be populated with so many senior business leaders, many of whom have never held public office, you know, this is going to be a kind of unprecedented set of global relationships that are going to be open to exposure.
Well, in Tillerson's case, he was skeptical of the Russians, and but then he decided to court Putin himself because he figured that if you're close to Putin, he's the capo di capos. He regulates all the oligarchs and the gangsters. And if you become his friend, then you're basically go right to the top in terms of being able to make deals, along with, of course, Igor Seshin as well, the head of Rosneft, the big oil monopoly, oil and gas monopoly.
Yeah.
So that seems to have been Tillerson's come to Jesus moment, right? That
As of 2008, he was decrying some of the absence of the rule of law. In Russia at that point, Putin was prime minister. But suddenly the tune changed when Putin came back to be president again for the second time. And, in 2011, they began to talk about the Arctic and about Exxon getting rights to drilling there and elsewhere. And suddenly, they began to to sign deals. It didn't speak well, I think, for the, there's something... nothing changed in Russia between 2008 and 2011 in terms of the rule of law, certainly in an improvement that would account for this. So, you have to just say, well, maybe the guy just was persuaded by Putin and, he got to know him and like him and suddenly he had a conversion experience. I think it was just raw economic interest. ExxonMobil suddenly got access that nobody else had. And, I think that's... doesn't speak well for the credentials of someone who's about to be our Secretary of State in terms of, what motivates people for the values and the positions they take.
Well, but, you got to, in this case, it's like choosing your poison in a way. On the one hand, we're told that Russia and America coming together with Trump and Tillerson and Session and Putin, all these buddies getting together, it means that the U.S. will have no restrictions on drill, baby, drill. Forget about global warming. Putin has contempt for global warming as Trump does. So we're just going to have this bonanza where of extraction, and even the possibility of the U.S. and Russia sort of allying against China. And against the Saudis and the Sunni jihadists as well. So it's not so much a complicated situation so much as a very cynical one that will basically what Trump and Tillerson saying, let's return to realpolitik. Let's forget about nation building and democracy. Let's work with gangster states and not preach, take the high road and preach American values and democracy. I mean, that's the way.
I think the real issue for Americans to come to grips with is that real politique, or is it just a sugar high that we're going to have for the next few years while we have cheap energy prices? And the climate suffers, and we encourage corruption and bribery in all kinds of places around the planet. We lose our moral credibility, such as it is in the world. In the long run, in the world that we're raising our children to live in, this is not a kind of place that we want to have. It's going to be a place with, not only the climate has been devastated by these policies. But, we're running this massive experiment in terms of what the world's scientific community has said, will be a disaster. So, but we're also running this kind of experiment with our own fundamental values. And I think to this, it may be explicable, it may be okay for the CEO of a major U.S. company to do business deals in various ways as they compete around the globe. I would argue that even there are standards to be met, and American companies have to be scrupulous about the way they do business. But that's different from the kind of, certainly whatever those standards are, the standards are completely different for public officials. I mean, they have to be held to a higher level of transparency and integrity. I think it's fair to ask, you know, what have these folks been doing up to now? Who have they walked with up to now? And what can we expect from that?
Well, James Henry, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
You're very, very welcome.
And again, I've been speaking with James Henry. He's an investigative economist and lawyer who's written widely about offshore and onshore tax havens, kleptocracy, and pirate banking. He's a senior fellow at the Columbia University Center for Sustainable Investment, a global justice fellow at Yale, a senior advisor at the Tax Justice Network, and a member of the New York Bar, and the author of The Blood Bankers. And he has an article at The American Interest, The Curious World of Donald Trump's Private Russian Connections. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into how much Donald Trump and his children are pushing the ethical envelope.
Sick and tired of being promised this and that. We work all day, we sweat and we slave to keep the wealthy fat. They fill our heads with promises and bamboozle us with facts. Then they blow false sincerity, then they laugh behind our backs.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Sheila Krumholz, who's the Executive Director of the Center for Responsive Politics, a nonpartisan organization that tracks money, politics, and influence in Washington. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sheila Krumholz.
Thank you so much.
And there are more and more questions arising over, there has been some questions for some time about Donald Trump not divesting himself of his many business assets in the way that presidents have done in the past. And apparently he feels that his children can run the companies, etc. But at the same time, the children themselves seem to be already starting to trade access. So this has raised a lot of questions. There's also questions about what's happening in terms of this inauguration. So are we going to have a situation here with, I mean, first of all, we have a very unconventional president, just to say the least. But is your sense that the rules in place now are there to be gamed? And what we're really talking about here is how far Trump and his children are prepared to push the ethical envelope?
Mm-hmm. Yes, let's be clear that these rules have been gamed. Whether they're intended or there to be gamed, I think is in question. But certainly past presidents, past administrations, and government officials have gamed the rules for the advantage of their party, their administration in the past. And there have been efforts to, you know, take stock and make changes. But the fact remains that access and influence are still bought and sold in our nation's capital and in our state capitals. So this is nothing new. I think what is very new with this candidate, with this our president-elect and his administration, is the level of holdings of conflicts based upon a vast number of real estate and other business holdings that are not going to be held in a blind trust, will not be divested, and therefore will be very much in the minds of the Trump family and of the people who wish to negotiate with and influence them. So we've already seen people choosing, foreign diplomats choosing not to stay at a place like the Waldorf Astoria, but instead choosing to stay at the Trump Hotel, maybe feeling pressured to. What would it look like if they chose not to? What would it look like by comparison with other governments' emissaries if they're staying at the Trump Hotel and we're not? So there are all kinds of considerations here, but the scale and number of investments of Trump and his family, I think, is kind of at the top of the list. It's just like unlike anything we've ever seen before in a president elect. And then, of course, going on from there, the role of the children in both now carrying on the business for their father and having a role in government, setting up meetings and access to their father and to government officials is, I think, unprecedented.
Well, just to get a comparison in terms of what's happening with the inauguration and the festivities surrounding it, in 2008, Obama's inaugural committee restricted individual contributions to $50,000, and they prohibited any corporation from giving money. 4 years later, they decided to drop the restrictions against corporations and individuals wrote checks more than $50,000. But in terms of what Trump is doing, in terms of the fundraising appeals obtained by the AP, the premium donors for Trump are $250,000 for individuals and $1 million for corporations. And you get four tickets to the inaugural ball, seats in the bleachers for the parade, tickets to the children's concert, and a meeting with the president's finance team to discuss the road ahead. So that's a bit of a jump from 50 grand to $1 million, well, to 250,000, and not having corporations and now charging corporations $1 million.
But to be fair, Trump is doing what Obama did in 2013. Boeing gave $1 million donation to the Obama, to the presidential inaugural committee in 2013. Yes, there was a shift, pretty vast difference from 2009 and 2017, but there is less of a gulf between the second inauguration for the Obama administration and what Trump is undertaking now with this inauguration. Mm-hmm. And there have been big donors and big access provided to those donors in administrations prior to 2009. So I hate to paint too stark a difference between what Trump's inaugural will look like and how it is being funded and what the perks or rewards menu will look like as compared to prior administrations, because we have seen this before.
And again, I'm speaking with Sheila Krumholz, Executive Director of the Center for Responsive Politics, a nonpartisan organization that tracks money, politics, and influence in Washington. The one little bit of a difference here seems to be with the sons and the daughter is offering up access in exchange for money, but sweetening it a little bit by saying that the money will go to charity. And in one case, the sons offered access to Trump during the inauguration weekend in exchange for $1 million donations to an unnamed conservation charity, which turned out to have a lot to do with the sons' fondness for shooting big game, etc. So that's, and of course, the daughter was talking about doing coffee. So what do you make of that? That's a sort of an interesting twist that you pay for access and at the same time the money goes to a good deed.
Yeah, I think the good deed is perhaps in the eye of the beholder, and more importantly, it's just a very disturbingly vague purpose, supporting an unnamed conservation charity. If that were truly driving the activity and the fundraising, one would think that would you know, the lead would be the name of the charity and the good work that the charity does. And rather than, you know, kind of as an afterthought, yes, and there will be a charity and as yet unnamed. But appearing to potentially have set this up to sell access and the possibility of influencing the next president and his administration. I mean, really, that it seems to be the takeaway for many. And I think it's legitimate to question how vague the purpose of this is. What let's learn more about the charitable organization this all goes to benefit. But then a close second is what is the impact on the rest of us? This is our government. This is our president. These are our policies that they will be implementing, and we will be affected. So who's lining up to gain access? We want to know who's gaining access. We want to know what they're asking for or talking about, what favors they are currying with the next president, with his officials, and what the impact ultimately would be on us. I think this would all be less disturbing, frankly, if we felt that this was an administration that is going to champion transparency, because if we all know how politics is played, and it can be an ugly business, and it can be there can be a lot of deals hammered out, favors traded, and we just want to be at a minimum. If we can't be there in the room, privy to who is in the room, what they want, and what they're getting in the end, and I think all we will can be assured of is that we will ultimately find out one day what they got in the end, but may not even be aware that there was money being traded for this access and influence. So I think it's absolutely critical that in a privately funded system such as ours, we have access to this information so that we can advocate on our own behalf rather than outsourcing that to our representatives, which don't look a lot like us, frankly, and may or may not be representing our best interests. So I think we as citizens must be armed with the facts and demand the right to know who is gaining entree and access and potentially influence with our president.
But this president-elect has changed the rules. He does consider himself an outsider, a non-politician, and as such, he's managed to essentially change the rules that benefit him greatly. He's been extremely resistant to even address the conflicts of interest, which are manifest and clear. He never released his taxes, in spite of efforts by the press. He's never had a press conference, and he's not likely to have too many press conferences. Nobody in the press ever asked him, for example, what happened during the Vietnam War. How come you didn't serve? Remember how Clinton was pilloried over that, and how George W. Bush was also pilloried over his not going to Vietnam. Don't you think that Donald Trump has set a new bar, in a sense, and the press have absolutely not been able to get him to go along with what politicians in the past have agreed to in terms of their transparency? So I'm not sure who to blame here.
Well, there's only so much a reporter can do when confronted with complete obstruction. So it is the job of the press to continue calling for transparency, and it's the job of the public, if they feel they have a right and need to know this information, to lend their voice to that call as well. So ultimately, the president, the administration, other government officials, barring any legal requirement for them to disclose things such as taxes for the presidential candidate, we have the opportunity to either accept that or to object and to call for and build momentum around a call, a plan, a strategy to make that required, a legal requirement. So if we don't like the way that a candidate is comporting themselves, their campaign, their administration, we need to, our recourse is to change the law, change the rules, a call for these rules to be put in place. Because, yes, this candidate has acted differently. He has thrown out the window many of the kind of norms of political engagement and, frankly, society that heretofore had been expected. So we're operating in a new landscape. The bar is set differently, and we have now a choice of either picking our battles and letting some go, but being kind of obstructionist in return. I personally don't look forward to a society where everything is at a fever pitch, everything is at a battle. I think we do need to also recognize that society is not going to en masse pick up and march in the same direction. So we need to, I think, be judicious about what is really important. And for Open Secrets, as a transparency organization, of course, we feel we can't do our job in researching the money, following the money trail, and exposing where it leads, who's involved, what they want, and then putting the facts out there and letting the chips fall where they may. So we can't do our work. The free press can't do its work. Voters ultimately can't do their work if they don't have access to information. That for us is absolutely fundamental. So I think we have a number of challenges in front of us, but people have recourse. It only requires that they are paying attention, willing to engage, and to raise their voices in unison before any change will come out of Washington. There has to be pressure put on public officials. They're not going to risk the political liability of acting without public support. But if the public does lend that pressure and support for change, we are not captive. We have recourse, but people just have not been willing to use their power. And so we have a certain coterie of Americans, a certain cohort on both the left and the right that are willing to vote and willing to engage. But a lot of Americans stayed home on Election Day. And I think that tells you how high the mountain is we have to climb.
Well, Sheila Krumholz, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
It has been my pleasure. Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Sheila Krumholz, who's Executive Director of the Center for Responsive Politics, a nonpartisan organization that tracks money, politics, and influence in Washington. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.